Relations and Public Affairs here at Geisinger. Thank you for joining the first of our weekly COVID-19 updates. A few housekeeping items before we start. This briefing is taking place using Skype broadcast in the last 30 minutes. You'll be able to hear us throughout, but we are unable to hear you. Dr. Rue will make some opening remarks and then we will take questions. Thank you to those who submitted those questions in advance. We'll get to some of these following Dr. Rue's remarks. You can also submit questions live using the Q&A panel and Skype broadcast. Please share your name and outlet when submitting a question so we know who's asking. And then as time allows, we'll take some of those live questions submitted via the Q&A. For those questions we don't get to, our media relations team will respond to those by end of day today. So we'll be in touch to get those over to you. And with that, I'm happy to introduce Geisinger's president and CEO, Dr. Jaewon Roo.
Thanks, Matt. And thank you to everybody who's joining us today for this virtual press conference. I'm actually going to take off my mask here for the purposes of audio to make sure my voice isn't muffled for you so you could hear me clearly. But as you all may know, we went to universal masking throughout our facilities, which is why I had the mask on. Anybody who steps foot in one of our buildings, whether it's an administrative space or a clinical space, as of a couple weeks ago, both patients and employees, we're doing universal masking. That's why I have my mask. But I want to thank you for your flexibility. You know, this is obviously something that typically when we do these, we like being in person better. But given the circumstances, we thought this made a lot more sense. But we appreciate you all bearing with us on that. I thought I would kick us off today just with some updates, and we are, you know, happy to fill you in on what we've been up to, why we've been doing it, which might even be the more important side of things, but also some of the facts and figures of what we're seeing and what we're also trying to get out into the communities by way of public service announcements and what folks can do to help. I'll start with the data. I think that's always a good place to start, and for us, where we always try to orient around a common set of facts. At this point, this is numbers as of April 16th, so just yesterday. We've tested right around 10,000 people, and we've been really lucky in terms of our testing capabilities. I'm sure we'll get into that a little bit later, but we've tested around 10,000 people. We follow criteria-based testing. The CDC has guidelines around who meets criteria, and we adhere to that pretty well. But we've tested 10,000, and about 15% of them, somewhere between 1,400 and 1,500 folks, have returned positive. The majority of those, I think it's important to mention, are able to go home and self-isolate, self-quarantine, and they make a totally fine recovery in the home. Now, some of them end up getting admitted, and we've seen about 250 or so requiring hospitalization of that 1,400, 1,500 who test positive. And we've been able to discharge so far 120 or so patients, many people recovering every day, many people coming off ventilators, many people getting out of the ICU environment into the standard hospital beds, and then subsequently getting discharged from our hospitals. And we're excited every time that happens because, of course, that's encouraging for our staff and our communities. As of yesterday, we have about 94 patients admitted throughout our many different campuses. The majority of those still continue to be in the Northeast, so Luzerne and Lackawanna County, making up two-thirds, maybe even three-quarters of that 94 number. And of that 94, 36 of them are in the ICU. We also have seen, of those that we've tested positive, 84 of those have been one of our 27,000 employees. So these are a lot of numbers I'm throwing at you, but we think it's important to understand the facts. And so if you look at our 84 employees that have tested positive, I think it roughly mirrors what's going on in the community. And it's also important to note that the majority of our employees who have tested positive, it appears as though they contracted the virus outside of the workplace and in the community, because we do know that it is out there in our communities. where do these numbers place us? So as far as our bed capacity is concerned, which we track constantly, not even daily at this point, it's an hourly tracking. We're lucky in that we're a fairly large health system. We have multiple campuses, and as a result, we're able to cross-leverage different campuses. So when one campus or one area becomes a hotbed, we're able to then cross-transfer to other campuses, which helps us to load balance, so to speak. But overall, we're seeing that less than half of our beds are occupied at this time. So we still continue to have that bed capacity. As case counts continue to increase, we'll have the capacity to accommodate them. So that's a good thing. And we've been planning for that. And I think most of you know that a few weeks ago, gosh, I think it was 4 weeks ago, we canceled all of our elective non-urgent procedures and also many of the non-urgent clinic appointments. And that created that extra capacity for us to be able to accommodate the needs related to COVID. At the same time, it's important to remember that people still get sick with things that are not COVID. People still have heart attacks. People still have strokes. People still have other care needs. And those are still patients that sit in our hospitals today. I mentioned earlier, as far as some of the trends that we're seeing, we saw probably a couple weeks ago, the cases starting to climb in Lackawanna County were outpacing some of the other areas that we serve. I think right now what we're seeing is that there's some early evidence or indication that that might be flattening, but Luzerne County still seems to be climbing. I think taken as an aggregate, Luzerne, Lackawanna, northeast area of our service geography, it's still climbing, but we think the rate of climb may be slowing down, but again, still too early to say. And all of our data modeling suggests that the rest of the areas that we serve, whether it's the central region, Danville, Bloomsburg, Lewisburg, and surrounding areas, or down near Harrisburg, or even out towards State College and beyond, we think those areas should see a peak that trails behind the Northeast by at least 3 or 4 weeks, if not longer. So that staggered peak dynamic, that staggered timing of when we anticipate the different regions seeing the peak of the virus, that is what allows us the ability to cross leverage our various resources and campuses. And in that regard, you know, we're pretty lucky there as well. Some other things to update you all on. I think it's, you know, every chance I get, I'm just super thankful and want to extend our appreciation and thanks to our workforce. I think first and foremost, this is just an unprecedented time, and it's disruptive, not just from a work and professional standpoint, but just in terms of what people are going through in their home lives as well. People with families and loved ones and obviously kids out of school and managing that and whatever may be happening to others in the family. This is a community-wide, in fact, worldwide impact that we're seeing from this virus. And so in the midst of all that, to also be able to manage the work needs and changing work needs, I think it's a testament to the dedication and commitment of our workforce. And so we're super thankful to what everyone is doing day in and day out. I just want to illustrate that a little bit. As I described earlier, we've had areas of our system that have less activity and then areas of our system that have more activity. And so what we've had to do is redeploy resources and people from these areas of less activity, let's say the clinics, into areas of more activity, whether it's the screening tents or the hospitals. And that's meant that people's jobs have changed from what they're used to doing. It's also meant that they've had to go through training in some cases where they're picking up skills that they haven't exercised in quite some time. And so all of this has been a lot of adapting and change and being nimble. And I can't say enough about our 27,000 employees because they've really risen to the occasion. The other call out that I want to make is for all the folks in the community. I think the tremendous show of support, encouragement, whether it's signs on posts or whether it's things drawn on chalk on the sidewalks, I think, or flowers that we've seen. Just the tremendous show of encouragement has been uplifting to all of our staff. And of course, the generosity. You know, we've seen donations come in, both big and small, whether it's masks, gloves, protective equipment, other things to help us really get our supplies in order and to help us with our readiness and preparedness efforts related to the virus. So we're super, super thankful there. While I'm on the community, I think five things that we've been trying to reiterate for everybody in the community that people can do, because at the end of the day, we are all in this together as one community, and we've been partnering with other hospitals and health systems as well to get this message out. These five things are critically important to continue to mitigate the spread and to continue to keep the curve as flat as possible, creating time for treatments and supplies and so forth. But those five things, you know, stay home as much as possible. I mean, obviously there are reasons to still go out that are essential. People have to go out for food, getting groceries, getting critical things. They may even need to go out into the outdoors in places where they can keep their distance for exercise. But other than those kinds of essential things, we encourage people to stay home as much as possible. Wash your hands. You all have heard this quite a bit. And I always joke, although it's not much of a joke, if your hands, if the backs of your hands, the skin is not rough by now, that means you're probably not washing enough. So please be attentive to that. Try to avoid touching your face. I think it's sort of a habit that many of us don't even realize. But in times like these, we know that the virus spreads through your nose, your mouth. And if you can minimize touching your face, that minimizes the spread. The other is wipe down surfaces and keep the contact surfaces clear, because there is some evidence that suggests that virus can spread that way as well. And lastly, give back and encourage one another. I think many of you have friends and neighbors that are elderly, and if you're running by the grocery store, check in on them and see if there's something they need. I think little acts of kindness like that will help our entire communities get through this. So those are some of the things I wanted to lead off with. I know that some folks submitted questions to start. Matt, I'm going to turn it back to you and see how you wanted to handle that. I know we have some of them in advance, and we wanted to take some live.
Thank you, Dr. Root. So we'll keep an eye out in the chat for any questions you all have live. But in the meantime, we'll ask some of the questions that were submitted in advance. The first is from the Press Enterprise. What steps is the hospital taking to keep COVID patients separate from other patients? Are staff moving between COVID units and non-COVID units? Are there teams dedicated specifically to treating those with coronavirus?
Yeah, I think our preparedness efforts really date back to January, where a team of our emergency preparedness folks were looking at supplies and so forth. And there was a diligent planning effort that then really kicked into a different gear as we got into February. But then once we were into March, and I alluded to this earlier, one of the first steps we did was canceling the elective non-urgent procedures. And in fact, we did that even prior to many others and prior to the governor's mandate to do so. What that did for us is it created capacity. And with that capacity, that allowed our facilities team to go in and create negative pressure areas of the hospital and also dedicated wings designed specifically to take care of COVID positive patients. That allowed us to do several things. That then allowed us to have staff that were dedicated in those areas and also to conserve our PPE, our personal protective equipment, because when you don't have, when you start consolidating in one area, you can don the PPE one time and see several different patients that may have the virus. And so this gives you an illustration of the kind of steps that went into place in order to allow us to create these separate sort of biocontainment units with negative pressure capabilities to minimize the spread. In those areas, the staff get specially trained. In fact, we have a biocontainment unit team that goes around to each of our campuses. They wear a different color, so it's pretty obvious to know who they are. And they help train the staff on getting the proper ways to don the right equipment, the proper ways to take the equipment off. And those things, believe it or not, are not intuitive. If you or I walked into those environments and someone said, go ahead and put the equipment on, I think we'd be 50-50 on whether we'd put it on properly. And so having those trained, dedicated expert staff there to help our folks, I think that's been a source of reassurance and calm. But that's just to give a snippet of the kind of effort and energy that went into preparation, but also what allowed us to make sure that the staff are sort of focused on these dedicated units. And that's been our approach throughout all of our campuses, not just here at GMC, but also at GWV in the Northeast, GCMC, or anywhere within our system.
Thank you, Dr. Root. Also from the Press Enterprise, are you providing alternative housing for staff who have tested positive so they don't bring it home to their families? Has any of the housing at Bloomsburg University been used by Geisinger staff yet?
Yeah, so I think this has been something we've been asked quite a bit, and it's important because we know that there are scenarios where staff are concerned about bringing this into the homes. There are scenarios where they may have been exposed potentially, or we're investigating or exploring that, and in the meantime, or it may just be they've worked a long shift and they need a place to grab a few hours, if not an overnight sleep, and we've set up various places for them to do that. And it includes, you know, your typical kind of hotel type of accommodations. But you mentioned a good example, which is Bloomsburg University. They've been one of our first partners in stepping up to the plate and offering up some of their capacity as far as where people can stay. We have initiated and had some staff stay there. I'm happy to report that the early feedback is resoundingly positive, as we knew it would be. I think it's been a huge way to not only support our employees, but also to work hand in hand with partners in the community that are willing to help support the effort as well. And Bloomsburg is one example. There are others, but yeah, it's been a big success story.
Thank you. And Bob Kalinowski from the Citizens Voice just wrote in, can you clarify between the 250 hospitalizations and the 94 admitted that you mentioned?
So the 250 is since the start of all of this. That's how many roughly we've admitted in total. The 94 is who sits in the hospital today, or sorry, yesterday. And so if you went and did a head count of everybody admitted in the hospital yesterday, that's the 94. If you did a head count of everybody who at any point up until now has been hospitalized in one of our facilities, that'd be the 250.
Thank you. The next question is from WKOK Radio. Is Geisinger using any of these new drugs to combat the virus, hydroxychloroquine, et cetera? What about antibody testing? And is there any research being done at Geisinger towards a vaccine?
Yeah, so a lot of things there. That's like a fourfer in one question, but I'll try to tackle it one at a time. I think just to start on the antibody testing, there's a lot in the news and the press on this, so I'll hit on that really quick. I think the quality and the accuracy of that testing is still not quite where it needs to be, and that's not for Geisinger, I'm talking as a country. The latest evidence that we've seen from our lab experts is that the specificity, so there are two things that you look at with any test, it's sort of a measure of accuracy, sensitivity, specificity. You don't want to miss things that are actually there. And at the same time, you don't want to say things are there when they're actually not. And so those two measures of a test's accuracy, with some of these serology tests or the antibody tests, it's no better than a coin flip at this point. And so we're waiting for that testing to continue to mature, which we think it will over the coming weeks. But it's just not where we would hang our hat on at this juncture. As far as some of the medications, whether it's hydroxychloroquine or some of the antivirals that are out there or another category of drugs which have anti-inflammatory properties, sort of called IL-6 inhibitors, these are all categories of drugs that are on our care protocol and pathway. We review this care protocol. Our experts in infectious disease, in critical medicine, critical care medicine, get together on a regular basis and review the latest and greatest evidence. and try to develop a care protocol of how should we be taking care of these folks. And what they've found is, you know, both of those sets of, or all three categories of those drugs are on our protocol. The evidence, I think, within the case of hydroxychloroquine is still, you know, not very clear. I think it's not definitive, not conclusive, but could there be a role? Maybe. So we have it on our protocol for people to consider, ultimately with the discretion landing in the physician's hands. But then with the other antivirals and the IL-6 inhibitors, there are clinical trials that were involved with one of the clinical trials. And I think some of the early anecdotal observations has been that we believe there's some benefit to the use of these. But we won't know definitively until we have that data from the clinical trials. That's why the science is really important. And we're trying to adhere to the science and study these in the context of an actual clinical trial, which compares the drug against, you know, placebo or do nothing, and really gives you a more informed view of how effective the drugs are. The other is convalescent serum. That's the other one we get asked about quite a bit. That's the serum of people who have already had COVID. And the theory is that those antibodies floating around in their serum might be helpful to those who are now newly infected. We are just getting into the early steps of a clinical trial related to that as well. So I think the punchline here is we're pretty active in studying it and contributing to the science, because when we do that, we know that our patients will benefit because we won't be guessing. We won't be doing hunches. We don't like to do that. We like to rely on data and evidence.
Thank you. Next question is from the Scranton Times. Lots of big city hospitals are overwhelmed with virus victims. Do you foresee this outbreak getting so bad that a Geisinger hospital will get overwhelmed? It would seem Danville hospitals, because of fewer cases there, might be able to handle some overflow from other places, especially because of its size.
Yeah, I think we already, I referenced the overflow dynamic even within our own system, you know, and that's where we know that certain areas, certain geographies, they're going to go through a wave at a different time than other geographies simply within the areas that we serve. And so the Northeast going through a wave probably sooner than many of the other geographies that we operate in. And so being able to cross-transfer, cross-leverage resources, bed capacity, staff, that's something that it's already a part of our game. And in fact, we've transferred a handful of folks from those Northeast campuses to the Danville campus already. As far as transfers in from other geographies, I think, I suppose that's always a possibility. But I think first and foremost, our responsibility is to our local community. And we know that there's still a lot we can do, and also a lot that we have to make sure we stay prepared for in the event that the virus really spreads quickly here. So that's our A number one priority. We're able to do that to some degree within our system. And as far as, you know, are there potential transfers from elsewhere in areas that are getting hit particularly hard, 2-3 hours away, I think that remains to be seen.
Thank you. Next question, also from the Scranton Times, WKOK and others have asked this as well. Local, state, and federal government has talked about lifting restrictions on some states and areas soon. Do you think Pennsylvania is ready for that? And how do you envision the gradual reopening of the economy?
Yeah, you know, what we've said is, and we're tracking the same national numbers as everybody else. And but at the same time, we track very local numbers and local trends and local dynamics. This is a local dynamic. And I think it's important to keep that in mind, because what is happening in New York is different than what's happening in our areas. What's happening in Philadelphia is different than what's happening in our areas. And just because you see some leveling off in the New York market, it doesn't mean that it's time to celebrate here. Because as we know, when we're tracking county by county, some counties are going to go faster, some will go slower than others. So I think the answer to that question really resides at a county by county level. But here's what I would say, still say feels a little premature, is we still see the case counts climbing. There may be some early indicators that in the Northeast it might be slowing down or flattening. A couple days don't make a trend, and so we'd feel a lot better about that if we saw a solid week or more of that. But at the same time, our other campuses still see a slow creeping up of these case counts. And so when you're consistently adding new cases into the mix, I personally don't feel comfortable saying that we've, you know, seen the worst of this thing. I think we're still going to have the worst in front of us. And so given that, I think the distancing efforts are still critically important. And given that, I think the testing and screening and all the precautions that we're taking are also critically important. Now, could there be a gradual reopening of some areas or some functions, whether it's within the health system or more broadly in the community? I think that might be something that could be, you know, I've kind of gotten out of the prediction game, Matt, as you know. But could that happen sometime in the coming weeks or even months? I think it could, but we got to be really careful. It's one of these things where I think we have to err on the side of caution. And we also know that this is a marathon and not a sprint. And so we're going to adhere to those things and try to keep tracking and following the data.
Thank you. Next question was submitted by the Daily Item. We've been told by employees who don't work directly with patients that they've been made to use one mask a week, including lab workers handling specimens and others. Does this weekly use of a single mask remain essential due to inventory concerns, or is it a balance of risk and availability? Might this soon be adjusted with the arrival of more supplies?
Yeah, I think this is, we get asked this question a lot as well, and it's really one about appropriateness. There are different scenarios, and if you're somebody who works in a lab, that's different than somebody who works inside a room where one of the COVID positive patients is intubated. And so depending on the scenario, again, going back to the science and the evidence, there are different levels of protections that are appropriate for different situations. In the same way that I wouldn't put jet fuel into my car, although my car could probably operate on that, but I don't think it's necessary to have my car have jet fuel. It wouldn't be appropriate. There are scenarios, and we want to make sure the protective equipment is used for the right scenario. And for the lower risk environments that people don't come into contact with the COVID positive patients, or the contact is what we would call contact precautions versus droplet precautions, so less risk of aerosolization or the virus getting into the air. Those are scenarios where you don't have to don as sophisticated of gear. And if you're in one of those environments where the patient's intubated, they're getting bronchoscopy, they're getting nebulized therapies, where there's a risk of the virus getting into the air, then you would need to crank up the level of sophistication of the protective gear. The other thing worth mentioning is our folks are pretty creative and innovative, and one of the things that we were very lucky early on was that they were able to refurbish or disinfect masks, in particular the N95s, using peroxide-based spray processes, which have subsequently become FDA approved, believe it or not. And I know other facilities, other organizations are pursuing UV light disinfectant processes, which are also safe. But going through that kind of process, testing it, making sure that it doesn't violate the integrity of these masks, have also allowed us to continue to be really good stewards of the equipment. Because as you all know, and you hear about, there's a worldwide shortage on some of these equipment, and we want to make sure that we're doing our part to be responsible with how we use them and using them appropriately so that we're prepared for anything that may come our way.
Thank you. I think we have time for one more question. We've received questions from several outlets asking about whether Geisinger has had to yet or expects to make any furloughs or layoffs. Can you address that?
Well, so far we've been focused a lot on redeployment. I think it gets to the we have areas where we've had significantly less activity than we typically do, and then other areas where we have significantly more, and being able to redirect resources from these environments over to these environments, that's been the area of our focus. I think what we envision happening, if in the event that we can't redeploy folks, I think it would be ultimately a combination of drawing from vacation time, CME time, if they're a provider, or unpaid leave. I think it'd be some combination of that. But what we did, gosh, I guess it was about a month ago, we announced that through April 25th, we would be having salary continuation for everybody, whether they're able to be redeployed or not, that we would continue that in support of our employees. And I know that our team is working on nailing down the final details of what the post-April 25th world might look like, but I think it's more consistent with what I described. But again, the focus of it being, let's try to redeploy our folks because there's still a heck of a lot of need and areas of need in order for us to be well-prepared.
Thank you, Dr. Rue. That concludes our press conference for today. Just a reminder, any questions we did not get to, we, the member of our media relations team, will get back to you by the end of the day. Thank you, everyone.